Hello and happy new year, one and all. I am Guy Hornsby and welcome to episode 7 of This Is Not Happening, our monthly music podcast from four of us, me, Nolan.
Hey, how's it going?
Joey.
Happy new year.
And David.
Happiest of new years.
Top that. After our review of 2020 in episode 6, we are back to the old routine of bringing an album of the month to the discussion and chatting about a track of our favourite choosing. If this is your first listen, welcome to This Is Not Happening. And perhaps dive into the previous half dozen. If you've dropped in before, great. For this episode, we are going back to the future for a new and unexpected album from one of music's demigods. You may have heard of him, some bloke called Paul McCartney. He was in a band called the Beatles once. Lifelong fan David is at the controls for this one. In the second half of the show, after that, we'll be talking about our favourite covers. To catch any of our previous 6 episodes, just head to thisisnothappening.buzzsprout.com or wherever you get your podcasts and search for This Is Not Happening. Last episode, we crammed the whole of 2020 into 1 hour or so and talked our top 10 albums and tracks of the year. If you want to look back, and we forgive you if you didn't, then check it out. Of course, you can catch us on a blog at thisisnothappening.net and for all our previous albums of the month, all sorts of great playlists, chat and about the music we love.
This is not happening.
Right, enough of the admin. It's time to get stuck into this episode's album of the month. And I can't think of a better person to take it on than David. There's been a lot of lockdown albums, but I'm not sure many come with a bigger name on this or a bigger expectation. David, tell us about McCartney 3 and your life with Paul.
You know that deep, deep feeling, the deep, deep pain. When you love someone so much, you feel your heart's gonna burst. The feeling goes best to
McCartney 3. Okay, well, as Guy has mentioned, let me get the obvious stuff out of the way. Calling me as a bit of a Beatles fan is a bit like calling the Pope a bit of a Catholic. I know the intimate minutiae of every part of the Beatles story. My daughter is named Astrid, partly because of Astrid Kircher, the Hamburg photographer who helped shape the Beatles look. They are woven into the very fabric of my being. But if you said to me a decade ago when we were first writing our blog together that I'd be nominating a contemporary late McCartney album for Album of the Month, I'd have had a word with myself because I would have said this is going to be a really bad idea. Paul has always been my guiding light, Beatles-wise. He was always the man for me, and I've had to suffer the slings and arrows over the years of the response to some of his work. But at the same time, I have to admit that his solo work is very much a mixed bag. For every band on the run, there's a frog chorus. It's the circle of life. However, I would add, what musician in their 70s is this not true of? Bowie made Tin Machine albums, for God's sake. The Stones' later albums are almost breathtakingly cynical cash-ins in their own sound. It's very hard not to repeat yourself, and maybe even harder not to fall out of love with the freshness and joy of songwriting. What you hope, I think, when you love an artist is for a surprise. Now, that happened big time with Bowie, first with his penultimate album The Next Day, and even deeper with his astonishing Black Star album. Now, I actually listened to Black Star this week. It's obviously been 5 years since Bowie's death, and I think it sounds even more astonishing now.
I'm exactly the same, David. I've had it on, like all week.
It's an astonishing
piece of work.
I don't think there'll ever be an album. A guy knowing he was going to die, writing about death.
It's got better and better. How can it be fresher 5 years later?
Totally. I'm not suggesting McCartney 3 is Black Star, but it's certainly a surprise. And for me, it is a very welcome one. Now, why did I nominate McCartney 3 when I'd avoided his previous contemporary albums? I think partly there is an emotional connection with the first two McCartney albums. For those who don't know, McCartney 1 was a low-key, folky affair made just after the Beatles split in 1970. McCartney 2, 10 years later, was a bolder, weirder affair full of electronic jams and downright odd songs. It's probably one of his most experimental albums. And I still can't believe Temporary Secretary was a single. I almost want you to play an excerpt now because it's so odd and strange. But obviously, an emotional connection isn't going to be good enough if the album isn't any good. Maybe it's because I'd heard that this album, which by the way is McCartney's 18th solo album, is one that he didn't set out to make. Or maybe it was the fact there's no big name producer on board. I think he's been hiding behind the producer on his albums for a while. Even the most lauded of his recent work, like Egypt Station, which was produced by Greg Kurstin, the Adele producer, and Chaos and the Creation in the Backyard, but it's produced by the radio producer, Nigel Godrich. They just haven't connected with me. I think they are overproduced and they're slick, but they lack something. And in particular, I don't think they let his rock songs really rock. Now, this is really important because so many people have forgotten that McCartney, the rocker, is a huge part of his musical personality. And I do want to mention the thing that you said, Joey. Has he been listening to Queens of the Stone Age? Now, obviously, if you know McCartney well, you're like, no, Queens of the Stone Age, like, listen to McCartney. But of course, people have forgotten that this is like something that he's very important part of who he is. And something that I think is one of the most successful parts of this album. Now, I think something has also shifted with McCartney in the public's musical public's affection. The first two McCartney albums were panned at the time, as were albums like Ram, and all of which are now regarded as trailblazers. Ram is seen as the first indie album. McCartney 1 is seen as having invented the lo-fi album. Things have changed. He's getting the credit he deserves. The question is, does McCartney 3 deserve that credit? Well, I can't wait to have this discussion. We've talked a lot on what's happened within each other and on the blog. And what's clear is we've got two big McCartney fans and two who are not big McCartney fans. And I think this is going to make for a really interesting debate. So I'd like to kick this off with this question. What did you think this album was going to be like when I suggested it? And what have you actually found that it's like? And I am going to start with Guy, the other McCartney fan.
You know, and if you haven't read it, head to the blog because I definitely got carried away. I make no secret of what a huge Beatles fan and actually a Paul McCartney fan I am. And I thought I was going to far outstrip everyone on this, and it probably just proves that I haven't known David as long as I've known Nolan, because I didn't know David's obsession extended far beyond me. I certainly don't have the spread of solo albums that he does, but I'm a big fan of McCartney 1 and 2, Wings, some of his solo stuff. I approach this with mixed emotions because I do like some songs off Egypt Station in particular. There's a couple of songs I really like off it, but it was really slick and really well produced. And I guess it just didn't have a lot of soul to it. And I think part of this is definitely placed in context with having grown up with the Beatles. You know, there wasn't that, no one sound that polished until the 1980s. When a lot of these synthesis came in and a lot of these things came in and had this much more cleaner, well-produced sound. So to me, the Beatles, and by definition, Paul, should sound a bit lo-fi and a bit scratchy and a bit imperfect and a bit like you did three takes and you're done. So listening to stuff like Egypt Station, so I guess I approached this with a kind of like, oh, he's made another solo album. Oh, it's a McCartney 3. Well, that's interesting because I know for a fact that would then mean he produced it and wrote everything and performed it all himself, which let's not to put too fine a point on it. How many people can make a decent album by doing that? Prince, Bowie didn't even do that. You've got to be a real multi-instrumentalist, but I still approached it with a like, this is going to be a bit like, great, great, you know, like, oh, you know, when I'm 78 kind of thing, you know. And so I guess I
was wondering how long it was going to be before we had an impression.
It was hope rather than expectation. But genuinely, I adore this album. I've got a huge amount of history with the Beatles. I try to separate my critical voice with my love for the Beatles, and I can almost have two different opinions of this. And my fan's opinion and my music lover's opinion is never going to be particularly partial, but it totally outstripped my expectations. And I know I like it, and I know I want to come back to it because I wake up singing it in my sleep. You know, and it isn't perfect. There's some cringeworthy stuff on there. You know, McCartney goes everywhere from writing incredible soul-bearing lyrics to, you know, stuff that really makes you cringe. But when you've written literally 800 songs or something, you're never going to hit it all the time.
To be fair, a lot of the albums have actually been sort of 4-star albums, haven't they? He's not getting 5-star albums across the view. A lot of them have said...
No, we talked about it with Sufjan. It feels like an unwillingness to criticise him. And I think what I find interesting about this is you talked about McCartney 1 and 2 being pretty panned at the time because the expectations were so massive for him. And probably by the 80s, he was like Bowie, becoming a little bit of an embarrassment, which is ironic now because people in their 40s make amazing music. So we just feel like he's been damned with a really poor kind of critical environment at that point. I wonder, perhaps, some of this is due to a rebound from that. And also to the point now where he's such a kind of god musically that it's almost rebounded the other way. It's a 4-star kind of album for me. It's not Black Star, but it's the best solo work he's put out since McCartney 2 for me, probably. On that high note, let's go to you, Joey. I'd love to know what you think about it.
I'm going to stop doing that fawning thing that like everybody of a whatever age should know about the Beatles, because I think it's bollocks. Unless you grew up with them, then I think it's completely acceptable to be a massive music head and not know too much about the Beatles or Paul McCartney. So my relationship with the Beatles is fairly sparse. My mum and dad didn't listen to them. My mum and dad, well, we listened to Dylan, we listened to Simon and Garfunkel, we listened to Stevie Wonder. So, like, I had a very kind of a very different musical heritage that kind of I was brought up on. We did have the White Album, we did have Sgt. Pepper's, and those are the two albums that I kind of know and love of the Beatles. But I also, sorry to say this, like, almost like really actively dislike a lot of Beatles tracks. They really nauseate me. In terms of Paul McCartney, the thing I was going to say that I'm so almost embarrassed about is I've almost like got no frame of reference.
Right.
Like, so in terms of my expectation, it was like, when you said that, I was thinking, shit, what was my expectation? I think my expectation was, well, it's probably going to be shit, isn't it? And then I thought, no, that's really unfair. I had no expectation. I had no idea what this was going to sound like.
Is that because you've not really been listening to anything he's done for, you know, a very, very long time? Or
no, I mean, there's like the Wings tracks that everybody knows. Mm. There's the Frog Chorus. His music just hasn't touched my life. So yeah. Therefore, like, I've got such a little like such a narrow window of like expectation, really. So it was with like really fresh ears, I guess, that I came to it. I also, out of total love and respect for you and Guy, decided to really put some effort into it and really try to develop a really honest opinion of it. And I guess my experience of listening to it is all over the shop. Track one, Long Tail Winter Bird. Anybody who had an acoustic guitar at some point and started writing songs, right, wrote that. Like, I'm sure I wrote that when I was about 12 with a guy called Bryn Ellis. So that was a bit of a weird, like, it was, yeah, a bit of a weird start. It was like, oh, is it gonna be that? Going through it, I was like, oh, right, okay. It's a bit of a blues man here, isn't he? It's like, he's definitely like leaning into kind of the blues influences, and particularly like guitar written blues. I was like, right, okay, this is like blues influenced garage rock. Like, and then that Queens of the Stone Age thing came in, and I was kind of thinking back to Queens of the Stone Age albums, thinking, God, which ones were more Beatles-y? Lullabies to Paralyze is the one that I think
totally
got the most influence.
Yeah.
But then actually, when I was listening back and thinking, like, the Queens of the Stone Age sounding tracks are actually earlier Queens of the Stone Age sounding tracks. So I kind of still stand by my, oh, has he been listening to some of that kind of like desert rock kind of stuff? So that was coming out. But one thing that I noticed was that I was listening to it quite a lot. I was like, I'm actually getting, like, I think I might be enjoying this. This is weird. But also another observation was that I was always doing something. So I took loads of photos of the kids and the family and stuff over Christmas, put some music on, edit some photos. And then I took it out for a walk, my infamous 40-minute walk. And then I started finding the holes in it. And the thing for me was the inconsistency, the lyrics.
You mean the musical inconsistency or the kind of composition?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So like, if somebody said to me, like, what do you look for in an album? I look for some kind of consistent musical theme to be being explored across a series of different tracks, but all having this common thread that runs through them, that binds them together, that makes them a holistic work of art.
Right.
And like, this isn't that. This is, like, I'd say this was kind of like a B-sides collection, or it's like a sketchbook of some admittedly really interesting ideas, but they simply don't hang together for
me. It's definitely
not finished, right?
But then that's also a very big reflection of what McCartney 1 and 2 were. Like, those two things came out of, you know,
but you've just I shouldn't need to know that to be able to enjoy this album.
But there is context. One, McCartney 1 and 2 came out of some pretty sort of strange times for him and were almost like an experimentation. And so is this. So I guess...
Sorry, Joey, you're right. It's a sketchbook, right? It's absolutely a sketchbook. And he, you know, and that's why he didn't even know he's writing an album.
Yeah, and he made it very clear, didn't he?
As a McCartney fan, which is why I'm sure we're going to have completely different, you know, responses to this. If you invested in this person and you kind of feel this affinity, being able to access a sketchbook that feels honest at this late in life is actually a complete treat.
Like, yeah, I completely agree with you. And something triggered in my mind actually years ago. Bradford Cox from Deer Hunter. You all know I'm a massive Deer Hunter. Atlas Sound.
Me too. Massive fan.
Like he released, and I say released, like literally just stuck it on their website or whatever. Like a 3-hour, like triple, quadruple albums worth of literally like demo sketches. And even I thought, oh God, but I was kind of intrigued enough. I just wanted to listen. And it was one of the most listenable. It's like, oh, right. I know how that song became that song. And I know how and you can see the anatomy and the kind of the genesis of all of these ideas brewing, but he didn't release it. It was what it was. It was a fanboy kind of.
I mean, you know, it's funny you mentioned Bradford Cox, because I think he is one of the songwriters I can think of is more influenced on McCartney than anyone else I can.
So like one of the things I wrote on the blog as well is like I've never been into the Beatles. However, I know I'm massively aware of the Beatles' influence on so many people that I love, and it isn't lost on me. It's just I never had the direct relationship.
So Nolan, I'm fascinated by your response, because I know you've struggled with it, maybe.
There's two points I want to go in on right now, because to what we've been discussing, I think the big thing for me is that, listen, Paul McCartney, absolute legend, 100%. And actually listening to this conversation and thinking about my relationship with Paul McCartney, I've not dipped in and out. It's just, he is at a point that he's got super control. We are at a point that you can release what you want to. This is an unfinished album. Like, it has so many good points. It feels like a half-hearted album.
But you know, it's interesting, the comparison with Sufjan. Yeah. Can I just say for listeners, obviously, we reviewed Sufjan Stevens' The Ascension on a previous episode, and it was an album we really struggled with because it was really overwrought, it was endlessly overproduced, and the songs were too long and they were exhausting. I think in a way what you're saying is this is the opposite, Nolan. Like it needs a bit more working on.
I'm not aware of his 18 albums. If you unless you're really into it, people don't. Like that's the way I see it. You know, I look at other people that are on his par for writing big songs and being consistent and doing stuff. And I'm always fascinated by their process and how they themselves, and they really.
Can you not hear that on this record? Can you not hear him trying to do that on this record to some degree?
You can't tell me that his lyrics on some of these songs are some of the worst lyrics I have ever heard.
Nolan, I'm with you 100%.
Find my way.
I love Find My Way.
I know my left and right.
Don't mistake simple lyrics for crap lyrics.
Last episode when we were talking about tracks of the year, we talked about Arlo Parks, and we talked about the simplicity of the lyrics to
Black Dog.
Thank you. Yeah. So I think we're all there. Like, lyrics don't have to be flamboyant or anything to be brilliant.
Yes, but they're throwaway. No, lyrics.
No, they're not. I don't agree. No, Find My Way has a direct lineage to Hello Goodbye. Okay.
Yeah.
You say goodbye, I say hello. Now, you might not like that song, and you know it does.
I actually do like that song.
Okay, fine. But that song is really interesting, because just the verse on its own, it's a bit pat. He's saying, "Hey, I'm here.
I'm here for you. It's great."
The anxious part is what makes that song.
Well, I can find my way. I know my left from right, because we never close. I'm open day and night.
He starts off and you're like, oh yeah, here I am, it's all great, you know, don't worry, I'll be here for you. And then when he talks about now you're overwhelmed by your anxieties, suddenly the rest of that song makes sense. I mean, yeah,
agreed.
Actually, I think that's the best pop song on the whole album.
And right. And listen,
actually,
listen.
I would add that to his canon, that song.
Okay, so number one, actually one of the best choruses on the album.
Yeah.
Musically, fantastic. Like, you go from the first track, Long Tailed, and I'm with you on this, David. What, like, I listened to this and I went, actually, I was about to veto this album, but this is going to be good, right?
Oh, I love that and opening song.
Find My Way starts, love it. Lyrics kick in, and I just started laughing, like, and said, why is he doing this? But then the chorus comes in, and it's great, and it brings back to the whole thing about great songwriters. You cannot tell me that he listened to that and went, oh, that's the best lyric I can do.
Right. He's not going to write let's think about Eleanor Rigby, for example, which he literally wrote when he was like 22 years old. And it's got the most pitiless lyrics, the viciously cold, you know, like dark lyrics about loneliness that are without sentiment, you know. Now, he's not going to write that. He's 78 years old. I think he's 78 and a 78-year-old man trying to express something about anxiety and trying to be there for somebody.
I love your emotion to this, but you got to see that they're not good lyrics.
No, but I guess what I'd say in response to this is, I think he'd be the first to admit that some of the lyrics on his songs aren't great. I mean, look.
I would say Imagine is one of the worst songs ever written. And it's a disgrace, actually, that song, because he, at the time, he was living in New York with Yoko when they had hired an entire apartment for their clothes. And he was saying Imagine No Possessions so he can get to fuck, okay?
Well, I think we're taking things a little bit too literally now.
I think Nolan's allowed this opinion without it being shot down, because there's two people on this pod who think the lyrics to too many of these songs are too bad for a non-fan and somebody without that lineage and
that's a good way of putting it.
Like, to be able to understand all of the background and how he got to write those lyrics, we've got to come at this album and listen to it as an album. And one of the questions I've been asking myself is, if this was somebody's debut, if we were looking at a new artist, like, what would we say? Well, we'd say, well, it's all over the shop. It's like a load of ideas. They need to work on the lyric, the blah, blah, blah. And just because it's Paul McCartney doesn't mean that you shouldn't be allowed to say that. But one of the things that I was thinking about is with this older artist thing, there are plenty of older artists that write awesome lyrics. Like Leonard Cohen, like, I think they were of a very similar age.
Leonard Cohen, Bob Dylan.
Dylan, you know, constantly, consistently.
Neil Young.
Elvis Costello. Yeah, there's all these people who are like true poets. And when you talk about somebody being one of the greatest songwriters who's ever walked the earth, you kind of need to judge them by the highest standards.
I agree. But I think David and I have both said the interesting thing about McCartney is, he has, for all those incredible highs, he's written some guff. There's two contexts to these reviews. There's lyrics in there that are, if you weren't a Beatles or a McCartney fan, you would have real problems with. Because when I got into the lyrics, I love listening to the album because the melodies and the songs and the songwriting is so enjoyable to me as a fan more than anything. But I agree. I listen to Seize the Day, or I listen to it's like The Kiss of Venus. It's some really twee stuff in there, and it does make me wince a bit, but I let it go because of how I feel. But absolutely take your point.
And we've got to accept that, and I'm quite enjoying that there's a 50-50 split on here, that the two of us are delving into our existing love affair and having it reaffirmed in some interesting ways. And you know, you talk about Nolan, about it being, it's unfinished, you know, it feels half-baked. And for me, I was never expecting again to hear a McCartney song and connect with it in a way that I had with his other work. I thought that was over, because what he'd been doing by hiding behind those producers.
I get that.
Hiding behind those producers, he produces his slick songs that sound like McCartney songs. He keeps rewriting Blackbird, doesn't he, as well? Bless him.
And I don't know. I really liked off, it's the only song I really liked off Egypt Station. But even then, it's too slick.
I think there is a part of Macca that's a bit naff. He's a bit like a nice avuncular, homely guy. Yeah, when you look into David Bowie's soul in later life, he's getting to an existential place. And when you look into McCartney's soul, he's going, oh yeah, great.
So a non-fan can never love this then?
Oh, I don't know about that.
I mean, who knows? Music appreciation is a strange beast. But I think if you came to this album having never listened to Paul McCartney, if you're a 50 or 60 year old, say, and you lived and you loved the music of the 60s and 70s, and you came to this album completely cold, I think there'd bits of it that you quite like.
But Joey, I love that question, actually. I think it goes to the heart of this, and it's why probably there won't be a meeting of minds on this.
You reckon?
No, because I think the answer probably is no. You probably can't love this album.
I agree with you.
You know,
and the more I listen to you and Guy, the more I'm convinced that this is it is part three of a trilogy, and you have to have seen all the other Marvel films to understand Endgame.
Okay, no, because I want to find some common ground here. Okay,
yeah.
So let us think about. I want to talk first of all about the positives. It's interesting when you compare into Leonard Cohen and Bob Dylan. The point about Paul McCartney here is, he is a pop artist. He is writing pops. And this is really important. They're not going to write Find My Way, right? Yeah. And do you know what? It's really hard to write Find My Way. The Bob Dylan album that came out last year was one of the highest reviewed albums of the year. I've heard a few tracks on the radio and they sounded like a drunk man falling down the stairs. I listened to the whole thing and I had exactly the same experience. I thought, I'm not a big enough fan to make any sense of why this is not an absolute piece of turd.
David, you're absolutely right. I went back and listened to the last Leonard Cohen.
Yeah.
And then listened to the Bob Dylan album. And I'm with you. Like, if you've loved Bob Dylan or Leonard Cohen your whole life,
then they add to it. Yeah.
100%. McCartney, much better presenting style. Lyric-wise, different camp those two were in compared to McCartney.
Of course.
That's my issue.
Because what Leonard Cohen's like a poet who sort of mumbles and sings. Dylan is like Dylan. McCartney's a pop singer.
But that's where I think Black Star becomes a really interesting comparison piece, because Black Star won new fans of absolutely every age group. And it's a really interesting comparison then. I completely understand your point about and being a 78-year-old pop singer writing pop songs is a very different thing. I get it.
I'm still hoping that McCartney, I mean, God, listen, I hope he lives to be 150. Dealing with Bowie's death was bad enough. I can't even imagine anybody. I hope he has another kind of weird epiphany where he goes into a weird dark place. But then maybe that's not what he's going to do.
One of the things I'm interested in for Guy and David, and I'm going to put this to you first, David, more than anything, because I think you proactively mentioned this. So there's only 11 tracks on the album.
Yeah.
I think you said at least one of them was awful. And that was Seize the Day,
Yeah, for me, the reviews have been really interesting because, but they pick up on different tracks that they don't like. So there's consistency.
No consistency.
And some people, you know, I really wanted to get to talk to Deep, Deep Feeling because it's the centerpiece of the album. But before we do that, I think some people have said Seize the Day is a highlight. I read the Pitchfork review, which just come out, says that Seize the Day is Super Fairy Animals-esque. I love the Super Fairy Animals. Seize the Day is not Super Fairy Animals-esque. I mean, the bloody Eskimo lyrics. I mean,
it's awful.
Oh,
it feels like someone who is awful in a Beatles tribute band has tried to write their own Beatles record.
Like a drunk
and
Beatles.
And I say that with awful. I say it with a heavy heart.
Can I just ask one? And this, I'm not trying. I promise you, I'm not trying to get you to dislike this album more. But like Lavatory Lil. So much for Lavatory Lil. So much for Lavatory Lil. You think she's being friendly, but she's looking for a Bentley, and she'd rather go and swallow a pill. Can we just discuss that as well?
See, I do not like it. It's the best thing about it is its riff.
My concern then is there's only 11 tracks. Two of them, the two people who love it, have said, like, they're bad songs.
So I, by the way, I haven't said Lavatory Lil's a bad song. Now, I know I'm walking the tightrope here.
I think it's not a bad song, but it's not. I don't like it compared to the rest of the album.
I really like the riff, and I love it when he rocks out. I really do. I really enjoy the sound of him on the drums and the guitar. It sounds fantastic. The lyrics are obviously about Heather. That's not very nice.
And for the benefit of people who don't have that knowledge, about Heather Mills, his ex-wife, who...
Yeah. You know what? Even though I don't really like this song, I love that song because of that. That he's actually gone out and done that. Because he is a massive public figure, and that whole thing with Heather Mills was always in the middle of a lot of stuff.
It was awful. It was an embarrassment.
And he showed some soul. And this is the whole thing that really frustrates me about the album is that, you know, musically throughout the album's great, right? But he's got points for half of a song, maybe 75% of a song, that it's brilliant. And he shows that emotion, but it's not finished.
I think that's the point of the album. And actually, the reason it's called McCartney 3, actually, I'll tell you what it totally succeeds as being, is a successor to McCartney 2 and McCartney 1, because it's just the same thing. McCartney 1 and McCartney 2 are, in some ways, frustrating albums because they're a little bit incomplete and they're weird because it's him on his own. And that's always going to be the case if you get one musician literally in a recording studio. And it's interesting thinking about the themes that he mines. You know, he touches on home life, simple life, life on a farm, anxiety, being there for people. It definitely loss about not being young anymore. I mean, One of my favorite songs on the album is Pretty Boys.
I love Pretty Boys.
I think that is a good lyric. A line of bicycles for hire, objects of desire.
Meet the pretty boys. A line of bicycles for hire, objects of desire.
And that is a fucking great couplet.
See, Pretty Boys is... I know there's like a low five in the album. Pretty Boys is finished. I don't think there's any polish to add to that.
I have three tracks that I genuinely love. Three songs that really surprised me. How much I loved them and how much I grew to love them. Because they weren't necessarily the tracks that stood out to me when I first heard it. So when I first listened, I was like, right, Sliding. That's my route in. And actually, I can take it or leave it now. I'm not really bothered. But my three... Women and Wives, Deep, Deep Feeling, and Deep Down. And I genuinely love everything about all three of those tracks. And that's kind of one of the reasons I've struggled so much with the album, because then there are three tracks that I hate and four tracks that I'm kind of indifferent about. But those three, I think there's something really special about everything.
And just briefly, what are those things? Or is it just that the feels? Is that imperceptible kind of just clicks?
Yeah, so the Women and Wives.
Hear me, women and wives. Hear me, husband and lovers. What we do with our lives seems to matter to others.
I just love that kind of, it's like a, like, piano-driven groove to it. It's really interesting. Women and Wives and Deep, Deep Feeling. One's 2.5 minutes long-ish. Deep, Deep Feeling's like 8.5, 9 minutes or something like that.
Yeah.
They both start, and you could almost imagine them both being like longer explorations of that groove. Yet one of them's really tight, really disciplined, but it's just that feel. Deep, Deep Feeling... Like that could have been 15 minutes for me. Just keep going, Paul. Oh. Just keep exploring that.
Yeah.
It was. I love that. I didn't find it to be overindulgent. I didn't find it to be arrogant. Like some of the reviews have really slated that song. Oh, this shows Paul at his most pompous and self-righteous and whatever. And then Deep Down, I heard it and it really reminds me of something and I can't think what it is. And then it hit me. It like could be on Mac Miller's Circles album from last year.
No, it's interesting that you pick those three tracks because they're the kind of downbeat groove. I mean, Deep, Deep Feeling, I have to say, whatever else happens today, that you love that track is like is the most affirmative thing.
Yeah.
Because I feel this might be the moment where we meet. Like, this might be the only moment.
You know that deep, deep feeling, the deep, deep pain, when you love someone so much, you feel your heart's gonna burst. The feeling goes from best to worst.
Like, as you said, it has divided. When I got into the headphones with this and I started walking around listening to it, because that's all we can do these days in lockdown universe, that was when the album opened itself up to me. When I listened to that a few times and I was like, oh man. I mean, Guy, you've noticed this on Twitter. He's been using ancient looping stuff, like really early technology. He's been He's been using really analog equipment to do it.
And
it feels like it when you listen to it because it doesn't sound digital at all, you know. It's interesting. Those lyrics could also be seen as trite and naff, you know.
But then Deep, Deep Feeling, it's so good. I kind of think that if you did a long-tailed Inner Bird, Deep, Deep Feeling, and I almost like, I love how he goes into the experimental thing, but I love that.
Because I'm trying to find commonality here, which is, I'm excited, right? I'm feeling an exciting moment where we might, all four of us, just for one moment on this podcast, feel the same thing, which is that, like, definitely happens on Deep, Deep Feeling. The emotional release of the music.
The music matches his feeling.
Yes!
Right. When did this become McCartney 3? Now, before you answer it, there's a danger that it being called McCartney 3 is kind of an affectation. That, like, did he set out to do... Like, no. And I think we all know that he didn't set out to finish the trilogy and do this like one man band thing. Some of your arguments there against what Nolan was saying was, you know, some of your points there would be valid for any other album if it wasn't McCartney 3. I think there's a hint of something in what Nolan's saying here that for me, there's a flatness in the production of too many of these tracks that could have been massively impacted by a producer like Steve Albini or something like that.
Or Rick Rubin.
I think the three tracks that I've picked are the ones that like leap off the record.
Yeah.
There's something in there. The rockier tracks, like it sounds like he's recorded them by himself on the farm. Like there isn't that kind of urgency and the drive.
He's never going to have a band ripping it up because it's only him.
This may be one of those moments where the thing that half of us love, the other half doesn't love. When you say who else could have been involved, it's not that he did not set out to make an album. And what I love about this is that he's such a musician that during lockdown, he was living with his daughter, Mary, and their kids and he was going to the studio nearby. And he was finishing some work on a film, I think, a soundtrack or something. And he just went to the studio every day because that's what he does as a musician. And these songs are a result of him just titting about in the studio. To people who don't enjoy that, it sounds like half-arsed titting about in the studio. And you're like, well, what the fuck? Come on, McCartney, get it together. What we're saying is, when we're saying it's McCartney 3, because it is McCartney 3, is that McCartney 1... and McCartney 2 were exactly the same thing.
Yeah,
they were.
I guess that was my point.
What we're saying is, when we're saying it's McCartney 3, because it is McCartney 3, is that McCartney 1 and McCartney 2 were exactly the same thing.
Yeah,
they were.
I guess that was my point.
Titting around in the studio at a point of crisis.
So I raised my other question, which is, can a non-fan ever love this then?
I really love this album, but I recognise its faults. So I definitely have songs that I love and songs that I don't. I actually really love Long Tail Winter Bird, simply because it kind of toys, there's a little bit of like tease and release to it. Every time the drum drops in and the bass comes in, I'm a bit like, yes, and then he takes it away, and I'm a bit like, no, and I kind of like that. I really love Pretty Boys, and I think there's a theme on this album that I really enjoy, that he sounds old now. There is no getting around it. And I think it's only in the last 10 or 12 years or so that he's really started to sound old. And I think what he's done on this album is he's embraced it. And that isn't fashionable to do as an artist. 100%. You're accepting your mortality.
Yep.
And the thing I love about Pretty Boys is he's not only sounding old, there's a nice like juxtaposition. He could be talking about David Bailey, but actually could be talking about his wife, who was a photographer. There's a lovely link to that between Mary taking those photos. I really like Women and Wives for a lot of the same reasons you do, Joey. And I adore Deep, Deep Feeling. And I think at its best, this is a really poignant album. Like, you know, to just touch very briefly on a theme we've talked about before, the whole Paul v. John thing. Paul was always seen as this kind of happy-go-lucky guy, and he was, you know, didn't do these like big emotional records. Well, he kind of did, but I think there's this, we talk about biases. David and I absolutely probably can't judge this unbiasedly because of our history with the band. But also, Paul coming out of the Beatles to McCartney 1 being as a sort of the wrecker of the band and this guy who can only write these kind of trite, happy pop songs. I mean, you look at his solo career, just two very brief examples. He wrote Maybe I'm Amazed and Every Night. They were songs about being depressed. Maybe I'm Amazed is about him expressing incredulity that his wife still wanted to be with him. And Every Night talks about not wanting to get out of bed in the morning. Yeah, I think unless you delve into that and you realize what he's writing about, people just be like, oh, it's this nice pop ballad. There's prejudices and angles on all sides of this, but ultimately, I will always love this album for it's an unexpected present that I never thought I'd get from McCartney. And I love it for probably a lot of the reasons you hate it. I've gone off him as a solo artist since probably McCartney 2, a lot of it, because it's too polished and he's just made the same stuff over again with less feeling and less emotional heft and less impact to me. And this album sounds like what I want him to sound like. And I agree that if that's not what is your thing is, then that is a perfectly good reason why anyone but a real fan of his wouldn't love it.
So Guy, can I ask you, just going back to that, what you were expecting and what you got, like the gap between that, what is that?
I was expecting much less than what I got, but it's so much more than I expected. And I guess that's the interesting thing. If you're maybe going to it thinking, oh, McCartney 3, I love McCartney 1 and 2, it's going to be absolutely amazing, I probably would have been a bit disappointed. But I just thought, oh, this could be a real unexpected coda to his career that I never thought I'd get. And of course it's not a black star, but then it's not trying to be.
But he's not Bowie.
Absolutely.
When I sort of pitched this as an album of the month, and there was some discussion and a bit of kickback, let's be honest, I was also really scared because I thought, what are you doing? And actually, I ordered the album on vinyl. I bought one of the stupid coloured vinyls. I thought, you're going to buy a vinyl and you're never going to listen to it because it's going to be one of those albums. I have listened to that on vinyl already more times than loads of records. And Joey and Nolan, it's not that I'm listening to it without the imperfections you're talking about. And it's funny about Caesar Day, because when you listen on vinyl, you can't, well, you can pick the needle up and skip the track, but essentially you don't, you just sit and listen to it. And it's really funny how you get used to the shit track and you're just like, oh, it's the shit track now, I'll just wait a minute. And I've forgotten that we used to do that all the time. 2/3 to this album, I really enjoy. Yeah. I really enjoy.
And to be fair, when I have listened to it, I have listened to it all the way through.
The whole point to what we do on a monthly level is that we recommend albums to people. I'm not going to recommend this album to anyone.
but I wouldn't have recommended The Ascension to anyone I know. And I haven't.
I think that there's elements that are really good. I think that he could have done better. That's my problem. Like,
this is a serious question. Are you guys annoyed that we don't like it?
No, I think it would be daft for someone to be annoyed that someone doesn't like an album. I really wish you did. But knowing now what I do about your experience and affinity to the Beatles and Paul McCartney's career, I'm actually not surprised you don't. I tell you why I would have been annoyed is if you felt the same way that I did about his entire career up to now and didn't like this. I'd be distraught.
Yeah, and I get that.
I actually feel like, and I hope we can reflect on this, is that I've really enjoyed, for example, your response to Deep, Deep Feeling. For me, that kind of if you can enjoy that, then we've enjoyed the record. Like, that's an 8-minute, it's a crazy weird jam with loops and kind of stuff. You dig it, it makes sense to you. You know, 78-year-old artist, how many tracks are you going to enjoy? Who knows? You know, and if you're not a big fan of their work already, I love that you love Women and Wives. Actually, there's a bit more in common than we think. I understand that it doesn't work for you as an album. Just as a counterpoint, because I think it's important to say this, if you have any relationship to the Beatles or McCartney at all, I would unequivocally recommend this album. I feel like it's a positive statement in a very bleak universe right now. I think it's got some positive things to say about the world. It's got things to say about caring about people around you, about living a simple life, about saying goodbye to the past. And that's not just him summing up his whole career. It's about him actually living in the world we live in right now. And, you know, in particular, what I love about Find My Way is I feel like it is a bit of a pandemic song, because it's saying, we're all feeling anxious, I'm here for you. Half our listeners probably are going to be you guys, and half the listeners are going to be me and Guy, right? Because that's how the world is. There are people who spent a lot of time in the Beatles and the people who didn't. And I'm saying, if you had any relationship with McCartney or the Beatles, this is going to surprise you and you're going to welcome it into your life. If you didn't, then probably it's going to be harder work.
After that dissection of McCartney 3, we come to the second half of the show, and we are each bringing a favourite cover to the table. There's so many incredible versions of so many records, it almost seems impossible to choose, but we've tried to do that in this episode. It makes you think about what is a good cover and what makes a good cover. What do you guys feel? Joey, what makes a good cover for you?
It's got to make me feel something a bit different than the original. I've got sort of significant antigens to kind of the quirky genre switch in a cover version, just for the sake of it. I kind of look for an emotional reinterpretation of something.
I'm with you on the feels, Joey. I think that's really important. But I do think there's something else that I really love, and I totally get what you're saying about the quirk. I mean, that's why they're really hard to do. I think really good covers are really hard to get to do. And actually, often you hear the same list of the same songs, because it actually offers you the song in a way where you go, Jesus, that's like a different song.
And what about you, Nolan? What do you think a cover has to bring to the party?
It needs to bring a new light onto the song for me. Where they usually get that happening is when you actually change the genre. But when people switch up the pace, what that generally does for me is that it opens your eyes to some of the lyric. That's a wonderful thing when it's done correctly.
If you're a band or you're an artist that does a cover, you have to do it true to what you are. Don't start inventing something that you feel it's going to be.
When a cover usurps the original and becomes the standard, then that is... You know, that then we're talking A-listers.
So let's dive in. I'm going to be first in this one. And I brought a massive Bruce Springsteen record, Dancing in the Dark, to the table, covered by Hot Chip. I actually pinged Hot Chip on Twitter about this, and Al came back and kind of said it was just a song that Alexis really liked and that he thought would make a good cover. And that's how it came about. There's no kind of grand plan with these things sometimes. And actually, when you talk about the single version, it came of it being a big live record for them around the Why Make Sense tour.
It's funny you mention it being a big live thing, because that was the first time I heard it. I saw them at Sonar. I think we were at the same Sonar, weren't we?
Yeah,
Barcelona. We were. And at the time when I saw it live, I was just like, oh, this is brilliant. Like, what a brilliant thing to do. And the audience, the crowd loved it. Everyone was, you know. And it's funny that when I've then heard it subsequently on record, I'm not as excited by that, you know, as I was. It's funny, I think it works so well. It was such a surprising thing to her live. I think almost in a way, the problem is it sounds so like a Hot Chip record that it sounds just like them. Yeah. And if you said, this is what Hot Chip will sound like covering Springsteen, it's exactly what it sounds like.
I'm not a big Springsteen fan. I do actually really love this record. This is probably going to come down to how much of a Springsteen fan you are. As to if a song that is covered is an emotional touchstone for you and someone else does it, there's always a risk that you're not going to like it. But I think I love this because of what it means to me from seeing it live. I've seen it live half a dozen times. Songs catch you at the strangest times. And I was listening to it in the car before we recorded. I got choked up listening to it because I think of that visceral remembrance of a number of brilliant gigs with friends of mine, and then obviously how much that's been taken away. These things, we talk about the feels. I get that it may not be the way that everyone else feels. I mean, who's a Springsteen fan here? Does anyone want to wade in?
Well, I think we all know that's me.
Yeah, yeah.
I grew up on Springsteen. However, I wasn't introduced to Springsteen by anybody other than myself. So, like, Springsteen was the first artist that I decided that I loved independently. In 1985, I was 8 and I got a cassette player and Born in the USA on cassette for my birthday. I think I literally wore it out. So that was like, you know, my sort of early pre-teens was like sat very emotionally listening to Springsteen records in my bedroom. Springsteen songs make me cry. I always felt them. My mum and dad were really worried about me listening to Springsteen because I'd used to cry and they'd ask me about why I was crying. And they were like horrified that I kind of got all of these songs and I understood them, and that kind of was that emotional connection. I do have a bit of a bone of contention with Springsteen covers. Springsteen headlined Glastonbury in 2009, I think it was. And as soon as he was announced, everybody started doing Springsteen covers. I don't like most of them. There's a Chromatics version of I'm on Fire, which I really like, and sung in a female voice. I really like it. Like, when I didn't even know Hot Chip had done this. And like you chose it, and I was like, oh no, I'm not going to like another one of Guy's tracks.
Talvin, come back.
and look, I've been on a real journey with it. The first time I heard it, I'll be totally honest with you, I was mortified.
Is it like when Nolan first heard Macca's lyrics?
Yeah.
Let's not go back.
Oh, yeah. Rewind. So,
the problem for me, it's not the kind of slightly dancier kind of reinterpretation of it. If you go back and listen to the Springsteen original, his vocal is so strong. It's a song about desperation and anguish and self-pity. I can genuinely feel the hairs on my neck standing on end as I'm saying that, and I'm kind of thinking about the original. And then you get the Hot Chip version with that sweet, almost falsetto, completely perfect and perfectly produced vocal, and it almost felt like, oh, do you not know what this song's about? Like, why would you sing it like that? And then you start asking yourself, well, does he need to sing it like that to have the same emotional heft? I did like an hour and a half training one day and I had it literally on repeat. I swear, there's no exaggeration.
It's commitment.
And it's grown on me. It's really grown on me. I still think it's a really barbed song. And I think the lyrics are so, as many Springsteen lyrics are, they're so plain and simple, it's almost difficult to reinterpret. And singing it without any barbs in that honey-like sweet voice still feels kind of disconnected to me.
You always run risk when you are covering a song as big as this song. You know, there's a lot to Bruce Springsteen that doesn't meet the eye. He was the voice to the working class, and you know, but he also very much in his lyrics, especially in this song, wore and wears his heart on his sleeve. And I think this is where I stumble a bit with this song. I get that it would be awesome live, but I stumble with it because I don't feel that the emotion is conveyed in this song when Hot Chip did it.
I think it does come down to when I hear it recorded as opposed to the live version, I do find myself thinking, have you quite understood what this song is saying? And also, I'm not quite sure, other than maybe it's just fun to do. And as a band, maybe that's great. And maybe it's for fans, and, you know, but maybe it stops short of having actually fulfilling one of the things we've said a cover version should do. Because I'm a big Hot Chip fan and I really enjoy this song, but I think I'm going to bin it because I don't think it has fulfilled what I want the cover version to do. I'm sorry.
Interesting. Unexpected. Joey?
Hey, it's the feels, right?
Look, this is a very binary question. I'm going to bin it. Sorry.
I'm going to bin it as well. Oh, but what I will say is that I would actually enjoy to see them play it live as part of their set.
Should we move on?
the next in line is Nolan. Take it away.
When I think about the song that I chose, it ticks all those boxes for me. And for me, it's the ultimate cover. And what I've chosen is Hurt by Johnny Cash.
What have I become? My sweetest friend. Everyone I know goes away.
Now, the history with this song for me is in 2002, I wasn't a Cash fan. A friend of David and I, Janie, she got me into Johnny Cash, or she was trying to get me into Johnny Cash. At the time, I knew someone at his record label. He was trying to get me into Johnny Cash. And I read an article with Zach De La Rocca talking about this song, Hurt. We talk about what's important to a cover song. And I think what makes this song magical to me is that it's like it's a song that Johnny Cash wrote about his life. You know, you need to remember 2002, he was starting to get back on track with his career. He'd done, I think, 4 covers albums with Rick Rubin. But, you know, on this album, he's got one of his original songs. It starts off When the Man Comes Around, which is an amazing song as well. And then it comes on to Hurt. This was also predated the Johnny Cash film. If you watch the Johnny Cash film, you'd think that this song was written for the Johnny Cash film. It just chills your bones. The original was done by, written by Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails. It's a very kind of industrial rock song. And Trent Reznor really wasn't down with it, apparently, when he first heard
it. It's one of his more accessible tracks.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But Trent Reznor is a great songwriter.
Trent Reznor's a musical genius.
He is. Now the thing is that Trent Reznor, being Trent Reznor, at first was like, I don't like it. But then when he really got stuck into it and listened to it, and I believe it was actually when he saw the music video for it, he was just like, this is like somebody has stolen your girlfriend, like in like a pure respectful way. That I mean, this isn't one of my favorite covers. This is one of my favorite songs of all time.
I'm not a Nine Inch Nails fan.
Really?
Not my fan. You'd be amazed amongst my extensive collection of foreign language pop that there's not been much room in my life for Nine Inch Nails. How very dare you stereotype me? And what's amazing about this song, the lyrics are astonishing and painful and personal. They could sound like the kind of pain that Cash has been through. It's so owned by Cash. And we've got to talk about Rick Rubin's production as well.
Sure.
And, you know, I think it's astonishing the space he gives to his voice, and it is impossibly moving. And for me, like, it's exactly what we want a cover to do.
And one of the other things that you probably don't know about me is that I do like Nine Inch Nails. I genuinely think that... Trent Reznor's a musical genius. He's one of the most sought after score writers in film today. And I didn't love the Nine Inch Nails track as much as I probably should have done. And I think the genius of this cover, and when you kind of like hit the chorus and Cash's voice just lifts you up, the Cash version is way more uplifting in that element of the song than the original. But it's the same notes. it's the same chord structure that goes beneath it. It's just the beauty of the performance, really. It's all in the voice, it's all in the production.
The video, you know, that got, including myself, into the song, they shot it in like the closed down Johnny Cash Museum, and his wife was in it, that obviously everybody knows from the movie, you know, was an amazing part of his life. But, you know, so many things were in line with it, and I am just continually blown away by this song years and years after I first heard it.
Nolan, true to form, when we were talking about covers on the WhatsApp group, you shot straight in with this, and actually it was one of my two or three that I was going to choose because it's so peerless. I mean, I think Rick Rubin sort of sprinkled some magic on that. I mean, actually, there's some other covers from those series that I love. I think his recover of Personal Jesus is amazing. He managed to catch that sweet spot of an artist who, like we referred to it in McCartney, actually, that understanding of his age and his physical and his mental condition and the period in his life.
Let's not forget that he actually died the following year. But this is a man at the end of his life, looking back on the pain of his life. I, that's what this song sounds like to me. So you said, oh yeah, Johnny Cash wrote this. You'd be like, of course he did. Because
he does it so well. It's his song. I think it's incredible.
Yeah, and I would echo that. Like, it's a classic example of I didn't know of the original when it came. I was really surprised. But you say the poignancy of that video, there are people that have lived lives that have taken to the very end of their kind of endurance. It is an emotionally crushing experience watching that, but it is musically and visually beautiful. You know, that whole My Empire of Dirt or Everyone I've Loved Goes Away in the End. It chokes you up watching it. So it is hard to top. And for me, I will spin it.
Spin it.
Spin it.
Obviously spinning it. Oh,
amazing.
Joey.
I'm bringing a song that I'm not claiming is the best cover version ever. I'm not claiming it to be my favorite cover version. I'm not claiming that my choice is better than the original. I am claiming that this is a cover that I feel massively passionate about. I think it's frequently overlooked and undervalued. And that's No Woman, No Cry by the Fugees.
Drinks, my only remedy for pain of losing family. But while I'm gone, shorty.
Obviously, everybody knows the original, and there have been loads of very good cover versions. Joan Baez, Nina Simone. The original falls into that like unimpeachable, like, who doesn't like No Woman, No Cry? It's like one of those tracks, isn't it? It's like I'm almost embarrassed that it's constantly in my top 10 tracks of all time. It's the first one I write down every single time, and I have done since I was about 10. The 1975 Live at the Lyceum version is as close to a perfect performance as I can think. And considering it was recorded live in 1975 is sonically captivating as well. It's the version. There is a studio version that was recorded. Don't bother. There's no reason to listen to that. So then the question becomes, like, why do you choose a cover of a song that you love so much? So what I love about this Fugees version, I actually think this is a Wyclef Jean track. I almost don't consider this to be a Fugees version. There's Lauren does some backing vocals that are pure as honey on this. They're beautiful, but this is Wyclef Jean all the way through. If you look at his solo work afterwards, like, this is kind of the touchstone that he keeps coming back to. For me, what I love about it is the repurposing of what the song is about. So the original was written by Bob for Rita Marley as a comfort while he was away from home. And as the lyrics that you all know of people they've lost along the journey. So No Woman, No Cry is derived from No Woman, Nuh, N-U-H, Cry. And Nuh in Jamaican patois means don't. So rather than saying, if you don't have a woman, there's nothing to cry about, it means no, don't cry because everything's going to be all right. Now, Wyclef immediately resets the meaning of this song with the opening shout out, this is a dedication to refugees worldwide. The subtle amendments to the lyrics all the way through the track leave you in no uncertain terms that this song therefore becomes about the pain of leaving family, becoming a refugee, and going to foreign lands in search of a better life. The first verse is subtly amended to talk about Wyclef's experience of going to the States. Verse 3 is exactly as the original. But verse 2 is the one that really lights it up for me. And that's the lyrics that have been changed the most. There's a line, my drink's my only remedy for pain of losing family. But while I'm gone, shorty, everything's going to be all right. Just really gets me in the feels every time. I'm not going to claim Wyclef Jean's vocal is, or his voice is as strong as Bob Marley's. But the performance, I think, of this vocal is like spine tingling. It's right on the edge of his capabilities. But if you want to hear somebody singing passionately about something and that gets me in the feels every single time, I absolutely love this. And it really brings something new to the track for me. And that's why I've chosen it.
It's an interesting choice. It wasn't what I was expecting you to choose at all, actually. No. Everywhere you went, every car had it blasting out of it. It's such an enjoyable record, and he had so many great tracks on it. I always struggled with this cover. It's really interesting listening to you talk about it. I found myself feeling bad for not taking more notice. I've heard this cover loads of times, and I've not paid enough attention to that, you know, that rethinking of the song, which certainly gives it context and makes me warm to it a lot more. At the same time, oh, you know, the shadow of the original, and particularly, I think, as you said, like Wycliffe's vocal performance, you just can't help but make that comparison.
Do you not like the vocal performance?
No, I like it, but it's not such a different retelling of the song that it reimagines it. So it is stepping in the footsteps of the song. So it does sound familiar. Actually, what you're saying is it's more radical than you realise. And that, I've got a lot of respect for that. Yeah.
Yeah. Again, this isn't like a genre shift cover, is it?
The emotion of it feels quite similar.
David, you've hit the nail on the head with this, is that it was part of an album that was so impactful for so many people. And for me, it's where it appears on the album. It's sandwiched right between a couple pretty intense songs. So it's, you know, it's almost at the end of the album. And I think it's almost like a sweetener in the middle of it. Wyclef really owned the song and he personalized it. He made it current. He made a song that was very old and about different things, very relevant to the album and the overall feel and the overall theme of the score.
Knowing what everyone said about this, I don't really know why I don't connect with it in the way that I should. I do understand those lyrics, actually. I remember thinking about them at the time. Originally, when I heard them changing it, it actually really pissed me off because I felt it was, until I thought about it, I was like, why are they messing with this? It's an absolute classic. It's, to me, along with Purple Rain, it's probably the best live record ever released. We talk about the feels. I think I'm all about the feels for this. And I don't quite connect to it. I loved the album at the time. I loved the score. It's so close to the original in many ways that it can only live in its shadow for me. And it's so hard for it to escape the orbit of such. It's like, you know, a moon trying to escape Jupiter. It just doesn't feel for me like that's possible. I think that's why, like David, I struggle with connecting it in the way that you do. So we spinning or binning it?
I'm going to spin it.
I'm spinning. I'm 100% spinning.
Oh, I'm really torn. I'm really torn.
Like Natalie Imbruglia, also a cover.
Also a cover?
Yeah. I'm going to bin it with a heavy heart because it just doesn't... I don't get the feels and you can't manufacture the feels.
You can't.
I'd be a rich man.
I thought I was going to bin it. Off the back of what you said, I am going to spin it and I've changed my mind.
Well, there we go. Finishing it off, David.
It's interesting, Joey, you said that No Woman, No Cry, the original, is in your top 10 and it sort of stays there nearly the whole time. This cover, I think, is in my top 10 records of all time. And I first came across it as the B-side to Pull Up to the Bumper, which I bought on 12-inch picture disc. This is Grace Jones's cover of Edith Piaf's La Vie en Rose. Which she first recorded on a slightly dodgy album she did of covers in the late 70s of sort of disco takes on some stuff. And it's not a great, her album, it's not her best work at all. But this stands out like a shining star on that record. And I think for me, if we're talking about a reinterpretation of a song, making it your own, turning it into something completely different. You know, the original, obviously, listeners will be aware of Edith Piaf. She was a chanson singer. She's very delicate and full of pain. And this, when Edith Piaf sings it, it's obviously a love song. It's a beautiful love song. But it feels like it's a love song by someone who's lived their life in anguish and is worried that it's going to be taken away from them again. There's a delicacy about Edith Piaf's performance. What Grace Jones does with it is... It sounds, I mean, just because the power of her voice and the way that she performs it, it feels like this incredible affirmation of love. When you hear Grace Jones talking about love, then you know that she fucking well means it because, like, she's not messing around here. But actually, it is also one of her most delicate performances. The beauty, also the way she sings the French, she, you know, swaps between French and English in the song, is absolutely, for me, devastating. We talk about the feels. I have definitely cried to this song more than once. If you put it on, the moment you hear that kind of bossa nova sort of opening, and the fact that also the arrangement, I mean, it is...
Tom Bolton, right? I mean,
yeah,
there's one of the dons of production. that entire decade.
Absolutely incredible. 7 minutes long. I will never, ever turn down the opportunity to play it. And I'm sure as soon as I get off here, I'm going to play it again. I've already played it today. I will be playing it again. You know, I have never got bored of listening to it. And I think it's astonishing.
I mean, I'm going to fully support you on this. I mean, Grace Jones is, I came to her in the 80s and I didn't, you know, like some of these artists, you don't come to them at the time of the release. I'd love to have been around when this was actually released. She owns this record and I actually love the original. There's some incredible, this is a great example of that genre bending, much like her. They're very closely matched in that respect. And that moment where she just goes to her upper register, as you say, it takes that frail, original, heartfelt of that kind of broken sparrow delivery of Edith Piaf and just does something mind-blowing with it.
Nolan, what do you reckon?
It's a remarkable attempt at an iconic song. And I do think she does a really, really, really good job. It's because it sits in that balance of what do you prefer, the original or this one? It's a tough one. And I think that I still sway to the original a little bit more.
Listening to Edith Piaf is, I love Edith Piaf, but I mean, it's not an easy listen. It's not something you put on the background. You know where it goes.
I just don't like it.
Do you like the original?
But I've been stewing over this for a couple of weeks now, and I'm not sure if I can describe my feelings to it any better than that. I just don't like it. I don't like the original. It kind of sets my nerves on edge. I can't really put my finger on why. I love the first minute of just pure bossa nova beat. It's lovely. Like I could listen to 7 minutes of that. Just think it simply isn't for me.
I mean, do you think it's more about the fact you don't like the song originally? Because I think her vocal performance is absolutely incredible. You know,
I think the vocal performance is incredible. Genuinely, I like the groove. You know, I like the exploration of a groove. Just like I couldn't think when I'd ever go to it.
So we're going to look at it, spinning and rebinning it then, guys. What do you reckon?
Oh, spinning it. Spinning it, without a doubt.
Nolan?
I'm going to bin it.
What the hell?
Well, no. It's a fine line that we've talked about is that, you know, whether I feel this is on par or better than the original, and I still prefer the original. So
fair shout.
No, fair enough. And Joey, I wonder what you're going to do.
Yeah, look, I'm going to bin it with the original. I'm probably going to seal the bin. No, I feel guilty.
Well, you know, I think feelings of regret and sadness is a great way to end the pod.
and genuinely, I think I'm constantly surprised by music that I think people would love just not working. It's the reason we've always talked about this stuff, right?
I've just been to Hot Chip track. I love Hot Chip.
Therefore, that is all we have time for episode 7 for This Is Not Happening. All the tracks you've heard in the last hour and useful links and info will be on the episode detail of the podcast when it comes out at the end of January. We've also posted playlists of our covers and some wider lists of ones we love, so keep an eye out for them as well. We'll be returning at the end of February with a long-awaited new album from Dancefloor Don's Bicep, just to switch it up. If you want to give us a review, head to ratethispodcast.com/thisisnothappening. Until then, enjoy the podcast, listen to the music. Maybe tell us if you love it and head to the blog if you want to join in with our discussions. Till episode 8, you've been listening to This Is Not Happening. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Ciao.
Fucking ciao.
Ciao.